It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 315 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we also have Mark Rubin on the line in San Jose, California.
Hello.
So is the sky all red and crusty in Seattle these days? I heard Oregon's getting bad.
Eastern Washington is getting stuff. When I went outside, it was just hazy when you looked in that direction. You could sort of smell it. But I imagine for Mark, you must be closer.
I went outside today and it was orange. Just
really?
Looking around. Yeah,
I heard Big Sur is burning. Is that true?
Maybe there's. I know there's one. There is a big one kind of around Yosemite. So Big Sur is on the coast. So it's possible.
Well, because Jane Fonda was on being interviewed on the radio today, and you never know with radio if it was like a live or it was done 2 weeks ago or whatever. But yeah, she mentioned that Big Sur was burning. So I don't know if that's true or not. But you know, I thought it ironic that you know with Apple on the brink of releasing Big Sur. Or has chosen a place that's like on fire, literally. Halt and catch fire, eh, honey?
Yeah, I'm looking at a map right now. I don't see, well, maybe so. Yeah, there is one little flame marker right around there.
Wow.
Yeah.
They have like a map now showing where the fire is?
Oh, yeah,
is?
Sure. Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
So, man, I clicked on this link that you sent out. Now I got this Apple thing stuck to my wall. It won't go away.
The event thing that has the little AR Easter egg?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was the one who posted that.
Yeah.
Is an Easter egg in it? If you look on your phone or whatever?
Yeah. I've seen it on my iPad and I've seen it on my iPhone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it doesn't work on macOS.
I was complaining to Tim that I got this thing stuck to my wall now. It won't go away.
Yeah. Oh, on your wall.
Did you do that? Did you take it far enough, Jaime, to it actually places, it doesn't just kind of move around. It places it on a wall if you move your phone around enough.
Yeah, I saw people playing with it online. I wonder what how they got that. Let me see. This is under MTGC, right? So how did you get the Easter egg? I don't get it.
You got to tap on the little logo, the little squiggly icon that's there, or squiggly design.
All right. Did you look if we have any Ask MTGC, honey?
I looked and it doesn't appear as if we do. And I didn't see anything notable that people were asking or commenting on in the Friends of the Show. Friends of the Show channel had, you know, stuff that people were saying, but nothing that seemed like a particular topic to bring forth to the broader crew.
Right. Well, they were all getting excited about the upcoming thing that we'll talk about later. And Palo Alto's lucky day. Well, all right. Well, we don't have any Ask MTGC here. I didn't do any fact check either. So I don't know if we did make any. I guess we had no mistakes, right?
If there's no fact check, there's no errors. The rule, I think.
That's the rule, yeah. Well, Greg wasn't very vocal this week, so I don't know if there was any fact check. Off you go with the follow-up then, I guess.
Yeah, first one relates to something we talked about, that iOS 14 was going to have that big breaking change for the IDFA, the identifier for advertiser. Turns out not so much, at least not immediately, to be more specific. So rather than being enforced right at the time and iOS 14 launches, presumably later this very month in September, it'll be, you know, early next year in 2021 when the big hammer will come down. And this article we have linked in the show notes for those of you driving at home comes from Ars Technica, and it really paints Facebook as being sort of the main driver. But I don't know that that's explicitly fair, even though they certainly made a big stink about it. But the entire ad industry as a whole is you know, quaking in its boots over the impact of this, right? And I actually listened to the most recent episode of Release Notes that Charles Perry and friend of the show, well, I guess both friends of the show, Charles Perry and Joe Chmielewski, and oh my gosh, I should know this answer. Here's a fact check on him. I don't remember the name of the person they were talking to, but they were from Revenue Cat and talking about some of the impacts of why this was very specifically a big change for identifiers being used.
Was that David Bernard they were talking to?
That sounds familiar. I'm going to take your word for it. I'm sure I could.
I'm looking at their show notes right now, so yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was a good discussion. Pretty reasonably fair. Granted, the source is somebody who's, you know, sort of notionally vested in the idea of something like the IDFA continuing to be useful. But the general gist is that the hope is that Apple will come up with something that is not only, you know, privacy-centric, but isn't quite as big a pendulum swing of like, well, now you can't get anything. And what does that right. mean for your advertising budget? You know, how will you effectively track that you are spending it wisely? Which is, you know, a fair question. I think even people who are indies out there who aren't trying to you know, dig into people's personal lives and just want to know, hey, I spent some dollars on Instagram app install ads. Mm-hmm. Was it useful or was I just throwing money down the toilet? That's true. That's throwing baby out with the bathwater that hopefully with the extra time, Apple will have a good balance, even though I'm definitely personally hoping for, you know, not so much of a loss on the privacy aspect, because I think that was something that was really a big part of what iOS 14 was going to have.
So it's kind of like app transport security coming in iOS 9. If you remember, they were going to, you know, shut everybody down who wasn't using TLS 1.2 and proper ciphers and stuff like that. And I don't think that's ever really been enforced, even though they talked about it.
For a while, they were saying they were going to turn off that allow arbitrary downloads,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
And they never turned that off.
No, you know, that said, I mean, the industry has sort of cleaned up its act to a certain extent, but you know, it's not really become a huge thing. I mean, you know, to this day. But so, can we just sort of cover off what this new iOS 14 feature is about? Like, in terms of how is Apple getting into the blocking the privacy? And I'm also disturbed by this image because they got in their article, because I looked at it and I went, where do they get these phones from, right? Because it's like a iPhone 8 and a XS and a XS R Max. It's like a really old image, right? But this WWDC thing that they talked about with the IDFA, what does it do, you know?
So the big change coming in iOS 14 was an explicit pop-up to the user saying, hey, this app is trying to use the IDFA to track you, allow or deny.
Right.
Which, if you are a normal person, you'd be like, what?
Hello.
No, yeah. I don't want people to track me. You know, just even the phrasing of it can prompt people to opt out. And in some industry research, it was upwards of, you know, 50 to 70 some percentage of people in their tests who would opt out. Presumably, these were user research tests to see, you know, what would you do in this situation sort of thing. And that has a real dramatic impact on your advertising spend. If you're somebody who, you know, is trying to advertise for your, let's say like your apps as an example. But it also means for people who sell advertising space, like the Facebooks and Googles of the world, it has a dramatic potential to impact their, you know, their revenue. So it definitely hits them in the wallet. And so there's, you know, enough of an impact and a very, very sizable one that it seems like Apple has taken the more pragmatic approach of like, all right, well, let's give them, you know, not just the 3 months of like, surprise, we told you this thing in June, and I really hope you completely revamped your entire industry within these most recent 3 months during the beta cycles. And all right, they say early 2021, I would guess it'd probably be like March. So you've effectively had, you know, 6 to 9 months to figure it out. And then, okay, iOS 14 version, you know, X, minor version X, will go ahead and slam the door shut and say, all right, I hope you figured it out because we've given you enough time to do so. so.
Yeah, I don't know. Hard to say. I mean, like, if Apple is already capitulating on this, will they continue to cave? I mean, the sad part about it is advertising is what puts food on the table for a lot of industries. I mean, like, you know, all these years we've been watching television. I mean, even Douglas Adams, who was, you know, famous for writing The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and all that kind of stuff, and he talked about being a television writer back in the day, and the purpose of writing television show wasn't to have a fence, you know, amazing, you know, of course he was an amazing science fiction writer and, you know, great compelling stories and stuff like that, but the main purpose of what he was doing was to put people in front of advertisers. That's what television was about back in the 70s when he was doing this stuff, right? Or 70s and 80s, I guess. But advertising is a huge part of how the world burns, right? So, you know, and, you know, cutting out, and right now, you know, we've all turned away from televisions and billboards and radios to, we're now looking at, you know, square boxes in our palms, right? That's where the you know, and if we're switching over to Netflixes and the Hulus and whatever, there's no advertising dollar there, right, for people, right? You know, like right now, we wouldn't be watching professional sports if it wasn't for advertising, right? You know, why would they even bother? I mean, you guys look at it and go, oh, look, the football game is on, right? But the reality is the football game is on to bring advertising to you. It's a tough decision to make. I get the whole, you know, protecting people's privacy and stuff like that, but I mean, the tracking is evil, don't get me wrong, but the whole idea of putting an advertisement in front of you is to entice you to buy some service or product, right? And it's tough to do that without if the main way of delivering that is taken away.
Yeah, I think one thing that and maybe this is covered as I'm recording this episode, they've only released part one of the interview on Release Notes. I wonder if part two ends up covering this, but one thing I would say is that we should split apart the two different ideas of advertising being a thing in general versus being able to have very highly targeted, very surgical selection of ads. Because the one thing that kept sort of echoing in the back of my mind is, yeah, that's great. You've made a claim here that, you know, people need to know how effective their advertising spend is, right? Like indies in particular, who don't have massive budgets. All right, fair. But that doesn't really explain the need to have tracking like an IDFA, right? Because I would say, well, in the real world, we have analogies for this. So like, well, how does Coca-Cola know that it's being effective in spending when it advertises on a TV show? That doesn't have tracking. Or on a radio show, like on NPR, that doesn't have tracking. Even better, what about billboards? Is that wasted money? I mean, do people have no clue what's going on there? Nobody knows how many people, if anybody, even looks up from the sidewalk to see a billboard. And yet, those industries still continue to move on, right? So I think this gets to the sort of a more fundamental thing of like, you kind of need to step back and say, well, what if the IDFA went completely away and nothing replaced it? Now what?
Not that I'm defending advertisers. I don't mean to do that. But the theory is that the more that they can target the advertising, I get it that, you know, this is not necessarily true, but this is the claim that the more they target, the more beneficial it is for the user, because the cost for the advertiser to reach you goes way down, because instead of them having to show this particular thing, whatever the thing is, to a million people to reach 10 people, now they only have to show it to, if it's in a perfect, you know, perfect system, they only have to show it to 10 people to reach 10 people. And because it costs them less, in theory, they can pass that cost savings on to you. Now, in reality, is that true? Probably not, but that is kind of the theory behind it. So it's a tough one, because it is true that the more scattered it is, you know, the putting up a big billboard, it does cost a lot more than pushing out these things. It is a tough one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, traditional, conventional advertising, I mean, like the whole idea, you had to repeatedly expose people to the message, right? So either you had to put the billboards everywhere, or you had to replace that art, that ad over and over again. Like in the case of magazine advertisements, they would put an ad in, they would run an ad like 12 times over a year, or not quite 12 times, but they would have to show it a number of times before you started to build a recognition and go, oh, that Pepsi thing. Oh yeah. I remember seeing that Pepsi thing somewhere else. And then, you know, and literally what you're doing is reading the same copy of the same magazine over and over again. But, and the way that that they would gather the information about how successful an ad was they would take a sample audience and they would send them a survey and they would ask them, do you remember seeing this product? Where did you see it? What does it make you think of? You know, and they would do those kind of things to sort of, you know, try and reverse engineer the benefit of the exposure, right? And whether or not people bought things or they used the coupons or whatever to buy the things. It was a very sort of, you know, labor-intensive mechanical method. The advantage we have now with all this nefarious ability to track is, you know, they can put an ad on a website, or they can put an ad in an iPhone or an ad, you know, AdMob or whatever, on Facebook or what have you, and they can actually get back metrics. That stuff is gold to an advertiser. Because before, like I said, they would have to have somebody standing in a shopping mall with a clipboard asking you to take a minute to give them an answer. Or in the case of television, they used to have these Nielsen ratings where, you know, they would take a sample of the audience and they would have a box sitting in their living room and they would push a button when they were watching a particular show, right? And that, you know, they used that as like a sample of the audience to get, you know, and I'm talking like a really small subset, right? You know, 1% or even less of, like, you know, who's watching this, you know, kind of thing. And there's stories you hear about, like, you know, Super Bowl, right? The amount of water used during Super Bowl just before halftime, you know, like, because everybody would run to the bathroom and, you know, have a wee and then run back and watch the halftime show, right? Like those kind of things, that's how they used to figure this stuff out. And you know, so you can imagine, you know, you give them the ability and the power to use like a Facebook, you know, hit or a pixel or whatever you want to call it, right? To measure what they're doing. It's much more scientific, you know, possibly better to do that. And now Apple's sort of taking that, you know, advantage away from them.
Well, of course, but the difference is, of course, that they're doing it without really knowing
your permission. Yeah, you didn't volunteer to have that Nielsen box in your living room. Exactly.
Yeah. For sure, Apple is doing it for the good of the user. You know, we've talked about this a lot of times. A lot of seemingly draconian, crazy, annoying things that Apple does, they're doing it not because they're mean. They're doing it because they, in their best opinion, that's the best thing for their real true customer, which is the end user, not for the developer.
Yeah, ourselves, as I like to say.
So there's got to be a fine line, or there's got to be a balance between where, you know, there's some, maybe they don't make it as, you know, as scary and you know, in your face that, hey, this is tracking you, as Apple's doing. But in return, the advertisers aren't so ruthless and conniving and sneaky about what they do with the information.
Yeah, I don't think they're really being nefarious. They're trying to make an honest living too, right?
Right.
I think.
Right. Well, some certainly are, of course.
Majority, yeah. I mean, the scammers and the hackers, they're not, or something else.
Right.
But the average Coke, you know, or Pepsi or Tesla even, you know, they're trying to measure their advertising dollar, and the way they do that is by looking at the statistics and see what people, you know, respond to, you know, whether they like ad A or ad B and all that kind of stuff, right? So, you know, tricky. We did interview, actually, one of our last episodes of Roundabout Creative Chaos. We spoke to Mike Vingemans, who is our voiceover guy. He's a creative writer, and a creative director in an advertising agency. And we asked him about the change in advertising in the time that he's been, you know, because he was there before the iPhone came along and rode all the way through that. And now, you know, having to sell ads to Google as opposed to selling ads to magazines, that's, you know, kind of what the experience he had. It was an interesting interview. I'll put a link in the show notes in there if people check that one out. All right. Move on.
Sure.
So this next one is a bit of a follow-up, just sort of a fun thing for Mark and myself. One of my friends from the Ray Runway group posted this on our Slack. The floppy of the future is here, and it's the 3.5-inch hard disk that Mark was talking about, showing a Sony floppy drive. And if you are a Mac user from way back when, until around, I want to say, the PowerPCs came out, they used to use Sony mechanisms, and they had that automatic eject feature. You can drag the floppy to the trash or Command E, and it would eject it automatically. But
which worked great until it didn't work.
Until it didn't work. Yeah, I actually have a plus that the floppy gets stuck in all the time, and I have to go and poke at it with a paperclip. But yeah, this is the 3.5-inch floppy disk that Mark was talking about. I have a whole box of them if anybody wants some. I've got some lying around here. But what does it say? 437.5 kilobytes, double density.
And people were psyched about that because that was so much more than the 5.5-inch or 5.25.
Yeah,
ones, which were like 100K.
They were like 800K at one point too, right? They were slightly smaller on Mac because of the resource forks, but I think 800K was when I got into Apple in 89, they were 800K floppy disks, the high density ones, right? Mm-hmm. A little HD stamp on the side of them. Yeah,
cool. Well, I remember when a 10 megabyte hard drive was a pretty amazing thing.
I remember when you could get a penny's worth of penny candy for a penny.
Wow. Well, you probably still can, but it just isn't. It isn't much.
Yeah, it's infinitesimal. Yeah. See it. We don't have pennies in Canada anymore. Do you guys? You guys still have pennies down there? You do, don't you?
We still have pennies, but they're always talking about getting rid of them.
Yeah, our smallest currency is a nickel, and so now when the device rounds up your purchase, if you pay by your Visa or your debit card, they will take the extra pennies. But if you're paying in cash, they always round up or down to the nearest nickel. Mm. So, yeah, which I kind of wonder about. Anywho, all right, what's next?
I think we talked about this, so I put it in the follow-up, but Apple Marina Bay Sands store has opened up in Singapore, and this isn't going to be very easy to describe in an audio-only medium, so link in the show notes, of course.
It's a sphere floating on the water. There, I described it.
I mean, yes, facetiously, it's very simply a sphere on the water, but it's quite the sphere made of like 114 individual pieces of glass held in place by 10 vertical mullions, and it looks amazing. I've seen some videos on YouTube on this. It seems like it lets in the light to give you natural lighting, but without having sort of a harshness to it. They've got, you know, trees inside, and I never really thought about a future where if somebody might reason with, say, you know, what happened to Jaime? Oh, he was at the Apple store and got lost at sea. as a potential thing that could happen.
Right. In a tsunami. Exactly. But, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the future, like, of this thing, because, you know, as you know, I studied architecture in university, and this design goes back to a building in Rome called the Parthenon, or Pantheon. And in it is, it's basically a dome building, right? And it's got the circular skylight at the top, right? Kind of thing. And inside, the inside volume of the building is actually a sphere, but it's like supported on four. It looks like a square building from outside with a dome, but it on the inside is actually a sphere just like this. This is a really kind of cool looking building. It's probably what, 40 or 50 feet high, you know, in the middle there, but they've just got the, you know, typical maple Apple store tables in the middle, right? So a lot of wasted space, but now they got trees growing in there and everything. It's looks pretty cool. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Pantheon or whatever. Nope, I'm going
to
see.
No, I'm going to have to Google that one because I don't know the shape.
I always thought of the Pantheon as the whole set of gods.
It might be.
Isn't that word used?
Does that mean it's the Parthenon as the building?
No, the Parthenon's a different building.
Maybe a different building, yeah.
Yeah, if you look at Pantheon in Rome. Yeah, if you go to the Wikipedia page, if you look at that building, on the outside, it looks like a typical Roman building, like with the post and lintel construction with the columns at the front, and they look Doric to me, and then they've got the breeze across the top, which is that triangle section, and then and it's got a square building behind it, and then it's got this sort of round, you know, circular building. But if you scroll down and look at the picture below, you'll see that it's a coffered ceiling, and the whole inside is in a big giant circle. Yeah, and you can see there's a shot of the ceiling from there. It's not made of mullions and glass, though. But I always thought it was kind of cool that the building had a big giant sphere in the middle of it. More than just code, folks. More than just code. Come for the architecture. All right. Got another one for Rami?
Yeah. I know we've talked about the security keys from Yubico. And I think the last time we talked about it, they had just started offering a lightning-based one that was compatible with the iPhone. So normally they've had like Bluetooth connectivity, they've had NFC, and then you'd have the iPhone one that was compatible with lightning. In this case, if you're wondering, how am I going to solve all of these different problems? Because lightning isn't going to work on my, or at least not without some sort of adapter, or my MacBook Pro, and if I had some sort of Android device, how does that work? It's like, well, now they have a USB-C security key that also has NFC. So presumably would end up sort of solving that one key to rule them all sort of thing. And that NFC could be used for the iPhones, assuming you had, you know, compatible hardware and your Android devices. And if you have a new USB-C based MacBook Pro, it still works for that.
Or iPad Pro. iPad Pro has
Oh, that's USB-C. True. iPad Pro. right, right. So something, if you're interested in having that extra layer of security, you know, somebody has figured out your passwords and, you know, you're wondering like, well, I don't want to use sort of normal 2FA stuff, you know, particularly over SMS or even the time-based one-time use codes. I really want to make sure that somebody has actually taken this token that I have. There you go. You've got your option there. I would highly recommend that you have, you know, this article claims that they are $55, but I think if you're going this route, you really, really want to make sure you have multiple of these. And if you're especially using something like a passwordless system that we talked about where you don't even create a password, this thing has the encrypted keys. You really want to register more than one of these in case one of these, you know, gets lost in the ocean while you're visiting the Marina Bay Sands in Singapore, so that you can have some sort of backup in like a secure deposit box at the bank or something, right? Or some other offsite location where, oh no, I lost my keys, which had the ring of the Yubico key. How do I get access to my email? Well, okay, as inconvenient as it is, at least you have an option and you're not forever locked out of your own system.
So notwithstanding the future plot of Mission Impossible, is it possible to have two copies of the same key, or do you register one or the other kind of?
You register multiple, is usually how those systems work.
So they each have a different token kind of thing, but
right. So
they can all unlock the same content.
So you would hypothetically have, you know, either key A or key B represent me as the authorized user. So, oh no,
I'm just trying not to give Tom Cruise any movie ideas. But by the way, just a real-time follow-up as well. But it does have a Yubico, they do have a Yubico key to that has Lightning on one end and USB-C on the other, right? So you could have the either or kind of thing. But according to this article I'm reading here, followed off of this one linked here, it does not work with the USB-C iPad Pro. No, don't know why.
Yeah, it's I'm sure there must be some sort of trade-off when it comes to manufacturability and some sort of pricing ratio and just troubleshooting. Like, I mean, hypothetically, and here's a product idea, you could have a Swiss Army knife type thing of like, all right, what connector have? USB-A, USB-C, micro USB, NFC, Lightning? I mean, you could right. go on and on if you wanted to have it. It's really difficult to come up with something that is going to be, you know, fairly robust, offer many uses, and can handle, you know, a lot of people carry these on their key rings. So it's got to handle being slammed around, you know, in cars, in pockets, that sort of thing.
So for those of you driving at home or wondering how this works, there is a link as well in this article that shows how to use them. And you apparently can link it with your Google account. So I guess that's using Google Authenticator, I guess. Yes, because you can add a key, like a security key to your account, as well as your regular 2FA or your Authenticator app. You can also pair it with your Twitter account and your Facebook account, if you dare.
Yeah, there's a lot that go out there. So I'm aware that Google has some sort of competitive product, and I forget what it's called, but it's the same idea. It's a hardware token in the shape of a key ringable thing. And I think they were passing those out to sort of high value targets, right? You're a journalist for the Washington Post, and you really want to make sure your Google account is secure, and probably your Twitter, your verified Twitter account and other things. It makes a lot of sense, again, depending on your threat model, right? But there is also, you know, convenience. Like we've talked about how great 1Password is, but it's like, yeah, it's also kind of cool to never have to worry about passwords, right? We still have the, whoops, what ends up happening if you lose a token sort of thing. And I think that's, again, why you should have more than one of these registered for your valuable accounts.
All right. Overture, hit the lights. This is it, the night of nights. And oh, what heights we'll hit. On with the show. This is it. What do you got for us now, Harmony?
Yeah, so since the last time we spoke on this show, Apple has actually sent out its events for its virtual event on September 15th with a whole thing that said, time flies. And the invitation logo is a Apple logo done in a sort of blue squiggly thing. And we'll talk more about that. Well, let's talk about the event. This Ars Technica article has, you know, its belief of what might possibly be unveiled. I leave it to the panel. What do you think as you use your Kremlinology of what does time flies and the design of this invitation mean to you? Or even just random stuff that you think might be announced at the event.
Time flies. Wow.
Well, clearly it's the new Apple self-flying car.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
right.
That they've been been talking about for all this time. And it'll have a little clock in the dashboard. That's where the time part comes in. But the flying is because it's the self-flying.
And it comes in white and 16 gig and 32 models, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Mind you, we were talking at the end of Spotcast last week that I had heard that the Apple Watch 7, is it 7? 6 or 7? 6, I guess, right? Where are we now?
I think
I have a Series 4. We were talking about this last week. I have a Series 4. There's a Series 5. And then so we're at 6, I think, right?
I believe that's correct. I think it's the 6.
Watch OS 7, Watch 6, Series 6. Anyway, so we were talking last week about that being delayed. So I wonder, they're obviously talking about, you know, the various iOSs, but there's a rumor of an iPad I heard as well. We talked about last week about the smaller HomePod, redone Apple TV, but I don't know.
Is it too obvious that the time part means a new watch? That might be a little too obvious.
Yeah.
You know, there's sort of two schools of thought. I went the very basic and obvious
route.
It's a
phone that tells time.
right. So I went the Apple Watch route. It's like, all right, I think that's at least one of the devices that'll be introduced there. The sort of more subtle and nuanced choice was people saying, it's maybe like an iPad upgrade with a time of flight type of sensor, you know, an enhanced one, which could be. And I think it's mentioned in this article, you know, time of flight sensor, something like an augmented reality 3D sensor included on the back of the latest iPad. So it may be an upgraded version of that. I lean towards maybe both. I'm kind of expecting a refreshed iPad of some sort. I don't know which one it'll be. I don't know if it'll be, because I haven't looked to see, you know, are the pros, the low-end models, you know, which ones. I suspect some sort of iPad with an Apple Watch as sort of the shortened event is what I think. I don't think the iPhone is going to make it for this particular one. And I definitely don't think the Apple Silicon-based Macs, because time flies just doesn't make sense at all for that particular iPad choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, sometimes time flies just means time flies. Since, you know, time has gone by faster than anyone thought, because we were all stuck at home. But, and maybe these are the new phones. Maybe that's all it is.
Well, according to this little update down here at the bottom that I can't click on anymore, Mark Gurman has surmised that it's exclusively about the Apple Watch, which doesn't make sense, because we know there has to be an event for announcing the phones, right?
Yeah, and, you know, you don't need a new phone necessarily for a new watch. So it presumably means that the timing of iOS 14, pretty much all you'd need to get available, you know, something that's usable with a new watch if you were to get your watch. And again, that's going with the idea that the phones themselves will be delayed in some way. They're presumably not even talked about at this event.
And they're telling us that time flies before we hear about the phone and we'll be able to order one?
I don't think they'll go the approach of talking about the phone, getting people excited, and then, oh, by the way, the phone's not available to late October, early November. I think instead they'll have a separate event in October for the iPhones. And I think it, given the rumors of like just how many phones they're coming out with this year, I forget what that is. It was like 3 or 4 models, I think. It could make sense. You have an event that's literally just the iPhones. And then you have this smaller one that's for, hey, we've got new Apple Watches, go buy them, and maybe something else.
What did they do when they introduced the watch? Was that the one where they had the big white building outside of
yes.
the campus?
Right. It was on De Anza College. I went down there and took some pictures of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A big white box, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. So we do this every time. Every time Apple has an announcement, they put out something that makes us scratch our heads and try to come up with what it means and decode the secret meaning. But does it ever really mean anything? Usually it doesn't, right?
Good point. Or it's so obscure we'll never be able to figure it out.
Right.
Maybe there's a book for somebody to write.
Yeah.
But are we going to talk about the special Easter egg now, or did we already talk about that?
No, this is actually a good time to talk about it. So if you go to the apple.com Apple events link that we have in the show notes, you do have to be on an iOS device of some sort, and it needs to be compatible. If you tap on that little blue squiggly logo, the AR quick look experience will pop up in your browser, and it does its nifty little animation. And if you haven't somehow gotten it stuck to your wall and can't find it sort of thing, it eventually squiggles itself into 9/15, which is September 15th, the date of the event. It's kind of neat.
But be careful. Like I said, you're going to have this thing stuck on your wall.
I don't know where it is now. I can't find it.
Stuck on your wall somewhere.
Oh, on my ceiling.
Oh, it's on your ceiling.
Upside down.
Oh, okay.
And it's got a shadow too. Hmm. That's the new hotness with it's upside down. That's funny.
So you have like a spider with its Charlotte's Web up there just hanging out
yeah.
in the rafters.
It'll stay as long as I keep this view open, I guess, right?
This is one of those weird sort of non-obvious problems with AR that for user interfaces, you're probably going to need some sort of hinting mechanism like arrows that know which way you're pointing and can tell you which way to reorient if you wanted to see the thing you cared about.
That was very exciting. Yeah. Glad we did that.
Wow, getting cynical.
Well, considering I tried to convince people to get into AR in 2014, maybe?
Yeah, that was too early.
Yeah, way too early.
Before AR kit. It's still a little too early right now.
It was a prominent manufacturer of chicken wings. You can have the chicken wing experience at home. They might be in the States too, but yeah, I think they are. And they used to advertise, you know, things like NASCAR and Super Bowl, stuff like that, football games. And our idea was, if you scan the logo with your phone, you know, something would pop out and, mm-hmm. you know, have some sort of AR experience. Because we used the company's logo as a trigger. It was mm-hmm. a nice black and white clear logo, right? Mm-hmm. And you could have triggered it off a television broadcast or whatever, right? So, and it would just be a way to, you know, but yeah, they just didn't get it. They didn't get it. Or at least it wasn't the company, but the agent who we were talking to trying to pitch the idea to didn't get it. Mm-hmm. Even though I had like little 3D robots running around on his desk and stuff like that. Yeah. And again, I think a lot of people didn't have phones back then too, so that was another issue. Right?
One thing I will say around augmented reality that I was thinking about while walking the dog, probably over the holiday weekend, was we're sort of in a weird spot with AR and VR to a big extent too, where it kind of feels like we still haven't had that watershed moment where somebody has really, really figured it out and made the you know, kick butt experience. And I look at it as being very similar to, you know, there were smartphones for a very long time before the iPhone came around. And the iPhone very clearly had the right idea. And now every phone is a smartphone for all intents and purposes. And darn near everybody who wants one has one. And I think we kind of need that for AR and VR. They've been hanging around for a while. The tech's been getting really cool, but cool tech doesn't make usable product, right?
Yeah, but we can, but I mean, in terms of things catching up, I mean, like QR codes is an example, right? No, we bash them a lot, but I mean, iPhones recognize them. I think Android phones recognize them now too, right? So there is sort of a convergence of experience in that sense, right? That if, you know, if you've got some sort of technology, and I'm assuming BlackBerry, for whatever's left of them, but the husk that they are, I guess they're running Android as well, right? So they kind of would have a common experience. But I mean, that's what it takes. It takes like iTunes was great, you know, and the iPod was great, but it wasn't until Apple released, you know, a Windows version of iTunes that the iPod actually started to take off and fly off the shelves, right? Because, you know, that they were missing that whole market. And now with AR, it's a technology that's been around a long time, you know, triggering off of targets and stuff like that. And even VR, we've been talking about VR since like the 90s, right? You know, virtual experiences and stuff like that for the handful of people that had computers back then too, right? It's taken a while for technology to catch up and become ubiquitous to the point where you could actually have these kind of experiences. And I think that's maybe why, you know, again, here's Apple leading from behind again, right? Taking such a long time to get to this point where we can use this technology. And hopefully, you know, knock on wood, Android kind of picks up and Google, whatever, pick up on it, right?
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned BlackBerry because they actually came to mind, as did Palm with its Trio as being one of those sort of prototype style.
They were smartphones. I mean, that's what they were called back then, yeah.
Yeah, they were smartphones, but they definitely weren't the modern smartphone. And, you know, was it a technology thing? Was it a difference in thinking? I don't know. If I had the answer, like, I wouldn't give it away on this very show. I'd quit my job, go get tons of VC money, and then a few years from now, I'd talk to you all from my helicopter and yacht, right?
Yeah, well, I think the thing about it is that it has to become so simple that anybody can do it, and that's where we're at now, right? Like, it's, you know, even though some people can't figure out how to record a voicemail message, at least they know how to, you know, open an app, and they know how to, you know, browse the web, and they know how to send an email from their phone now, which is something, or send a text even, right? Like, I'm looking at people my generation, you know, who, I was just talking to a friend of mine on Facebook today, who I just, you know, I hung out with him when I was like 15, and
you know, we just met up again on Facebook a couple of weeks ago and months ago, I guess. And I asked him, like, where's the rest of the gang? And he's like, I have no idea, right? And it's because people my age have no idea how to really use their phones, right? They don't, they're not like, they're not hip and happening like you, I mean, you know, they don't even know what Reddit is, right? But it, but it, what I mean, though, is that, like, in terms of a technology to sort of take off, it has to get to the point where it's so simple, you know, that your mom can do it.
Yeah. So I think it's one of those things where I'll be very curious to see, because I still don't know, is there some fundamental change to the form factor that's going to have to happen? Like maybe it just isn't really meant to take off in phones and iPads and, you know, laptops and stuff. Maybe it needs glasses or contact lenses or brain implants, neural implants of some sort.
That's what I mean. Like, it requires a company like Apple who has the ability to make things, you know, so simple and seamless, and they get out of people's way, right? I mean, that's the biggest problem with this whole AR experience, as I see it today, is that even developers, right, you know, Apple needs to get out of the way of the developers, because, you know, when I was talking about doing AR back in the day, you had to get, you know, the Qualcomm framework downloaded into your app and, you know, and all kinds of other things, and you had to design something in Blender to make it, you know, to animate a figure to walk across the person's desk, and you had to, you know, trigger, you know, figure out how to trigger off a stale image and make experiences happen, and that's not for the faint of heart, right?
Well, you can't blame Apple for that, though.
No, I'm not blaming Apple. What I'm saying is Apple is the company that can, I mean, they've put LiDAR into my iPad already. I mean, I went upstairs, you know, into an empty room that Carol and I were working on, and I threw an IKEA table and chairs down on the floor, but just by, you know, scanning the room for like 30 seconds, and boom, I had a table and chair from IKEA sitting in the room, and Carol could see what it would look like. You know, that's when I can do something like that and just show her, like, look, this is how simple it is to do an AR experience. She's like, wow, this is great. You know, and next thing I know, she's getting me to measure the whole room, and she runs off to IKEA with the floor plan. You know, I used to, I think we mentioned on the show, I used an app to measure the room with the iPad, right? But I mean, it took Apple to get to the point where they put LiDAR in the iPad, and they empowered the developers to make the software simple enough that it's, for me, just point and shoot, right? Like, it's like the old analog cameras. If you had a manual camera, you had to understand aperture, lighting, film speed, you know, all kinds of things to get a decent photo. Now you just point your iPhone at it, and boom, you're an Instagram hero, right? So that's what I mean about Apple. I'm not blaming Apple. I'm saying Apple is the type of company that, and Google to a certain extent, is the kind of company that could make that happen for people. So looking at the rest of the stuff on this page, fortunately for us, they have links to previous special events, right? So on September 12th, 2018, they announced the iPhone XS, the XS Max, XR, and the new Watch Series 4. And then again in September 10th of 2019, just a year ago, time flies, it was the iPhone 11 Pro, the iPhone 11, the Apple Watch Series 5, and the new iPad Pro, the iPad Pro came out earlier. Yeah, so I'm going to go with, like, looking at the pattern of, you know, the last two Septembers, got to be iPhones and watches, right?
Maybe. I would say that this is kind of an unusual year, in that there already is the rumor that given pandemic impacts to the manufacturing base, I could see iPhones being delayed. And then if you're Apple, you say, well, so then what do we do with events? We don't necessarily have to have the event the same sort of week that we take the pre-orders for. I think the iPhone X was like a month later, I think, from when it was announced. But I think there's a different factor there where, you know, pre-pandemic, as much as Apple sort of gets a lot of love and attention from the press, because, you know, Apple News is big news, which means big advertising dollars. There's really only so much that I think even a company like Apple could push of, like, all right, everybody from the entire world who's press, fly into Cupertino and see this thing. You know, I can see where in past events, they kind of tried to shove them together as much as possible to get as many products out there as you could. Whereas now, when it's all virtual, you know, they could have one of the events every day if they wanted to, right? It would be like a WWDC, hey, we're releasing one model a day sort of thing. Not saying they should do that, but it's certainly easier to say, all right, the press is going to attend with air quotes virtually, and, you know, they'll watch on the stream. I think it's a little easier to split up into smaller, more focused events, like an Apple Watch only event, and then later a phones only event, and then later an Apple Silicon Mac based event if you wanted to. Like, it's certainly more plausible and say, hey, remember how you left your family for like 3 to 4 days? We're going to do that 3 times this month or 3 times this quarter. Well, is probably a little bit
they
more
did do it in 2018, because I'm looking here on this the same thing. Like I mentioned, that September they announced the phones and the watch. Like a month later, October 30th, the day before Halloween, they had iPad Pro, MacBook Air, and Mac Mini. That's in 2018, right? So there is a precedent for them having two separate events. And they did the same thing like when they first rolled out the watch too, right? That was a separate event as well. So yeah, there is precedent for them to do it. And now that they're virtual, like what's the harm in doing, you know, one event this week and then another event in 2 weeks, right? Because there's, you know, other than production time, it's not, you know, you're not flying, you know, the Rennie Ritchies and the John Grubers and the Federico Fratichis to California for announcements, right? So they can just as easily do that, you know, remotely in this new, you know, Zoom calling world, right? I live in. Yeah, that's what I think.
I don't know. You guys have summed it up pretty well. I'm kind of not expecting iPads for some reason. It just doesn't feel like iPad time, but I could be wrong. I'm thinking phones, but I get it that, you know, they could be delayed. But, you know, chances are it's probably a watch thing. I mean, it's just a little too cute for it not to be a watch thing with the name and all that, even, you know, even with all I've said. But if they do release that flying car, then I'm going to be famous.
You'll get one, definitely.
Yeah.
you get up at midnight and order one.
That's right.
Let's say it is a watch, right? What can they possibly do to the watch to make it in any more compelling than the watches we have now?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Yeah.
Right? I mean, you've got the, you know, the heart thing, you got the fitness thing, and you know, when the watch first came out, we're like, what are they going to do with the watch, right? What's it going to be like? And you know, I think I considered buying my first watch app this week, but I didn't do it. But you know, like we've been talking about having a watch store, we finally got a watch store, I think last year, right?
We got standalone apps. It didn't change the world.
No. So what's the big compelling? Why would they have such a big event for just a watch, right? I mean, notwithstanding the first event, but
yeah.
I mean, Oreo continues to make cookies even when you know personally don't require them. It's not like they do them on demand when you go to the store. So
Oreos are amazing. Apple Watches are you know.
But but Nabisco doesn't have an enormous enormous event telling the world about the new cookie. I guess they have advertising,
right. But yeah. This one has double stuff.
Yeah. Mm. It would have to be, if it were just a watch, it would have to be kind of a letdown, I think, the event. Unless, you know, unless it shoots lasers or something. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, or maybe.
Steers your flying car.
Yeah.
My imagination might not be too good, but I'm struggling to think of things that aren't, you know, nice refinements, but not sort of killer necessities. Like, we know they already have the always-on face, which was a sort of a deal breaker for people. We know that they probably haven't cracked the, you know, 1 week of battery life problem, because that's a huge, I mean, they should stop selling watches and start getting into the battery business if that's the case, if they've solved that problem. Maybe additional health sensors, you know, those could be nice. Not knocking those. I think stuff like the ECG, EKG are really cool. You know, maybe other things tracking, you know, O2, which they might have, tracking blood sugar, which would be really cool. I'm not diabetic, but sure, we could be kind of nice to have data tracking in case that ended up happening. I don't know. Maybe my imagination's just not good enough, but I'm sitting here with a Series 3 and I'm like, I might not need that much convincing to go ahead and buy one, whatever the heck they come out with, and just say, yeah, have a decent enough upgrade to my watch and be able to sell my watch while it continues to have some amount of trade-in value instead of, you know, riding it, you know, into the ground as I could as an alternative.
So can you use a watch as a trade-in on another device or another piece of hardware, right? I wonder what my developer watch is worth these days.
Good question.
OG. It's only worth something as a keepsake, right? Alrighty. What do you got next?
This is an article by Guillaume Rambo, whose name comes up quite a bit as somebody who goes spelunking into the world of what is Apple up to sort of thing. But in this case, he's got an article here about his app Chibi Studio and how he sort of worked to get it made available as an app clip for iOS 14 and some of the challenges he had to go through. So Chibi Studio, as I understand it, is a app that you can use to make cutesy anime avatars sort of thing. And as I understand from this article, apparently there's all tons of assets that go into that particular app. And this presents sort of a particular problem because, as folks who might remember, app clips only allow you to have 10 megabytes of total total size. And even when you go through app thinning, it's like, there's still like a lot of stuff that I ended up with a problem of dealing. So it's like, all right, how am I going to get this to work? It turns out that he did some things like some of his assets, instead of having them in, I forget which format he had with a particular compression, but he ended up reducing his vector data size with LZMA compression, which worked out better for him than good old Zlib. So he had looked at Apple's compression framework and saw that there was a higher compression ratio promised by LZMA, and he decided to try it out. And it did a pretty good job. So he went from 127.6 megs to 78.5 without impacting the runtime performance in any noticeable way. So that's good. So it sounds like an overall win for his particular use case. But he was still having issues like, oh my gosh, like, you know, how do I get this thing to fit? And he realized that, well, something that he was doing before, an engineering trade-off he had made, was that he had preview images that were pre-baked, because whenever it was that he started creating this app, this Chibi Studio, phones just would, you know, on the market, and not like the latest and greatest necessarily, but the, you know, fleet of phones that he was looking to support, wouldn't necessarily be able to quickly churn out those preview thumbnails on the fly. So he ended up with even more assets for, you know, imagine there's like a funny hat for your character, and you have not only the full size asset for that, but you also have some thumbnail version, and so on and so forth for every asset he had. He said, well, I wonder if I can just generate these on the fly, and what would happen? And he tried it out, and it ended up working for him. And looking here at the article, this design decision he had made, this technical decision, was back when iOS 10 was in the heyday. So here we are, you know, some 4 years later, and devices have gotten fast enough for, oh, not a big deal. Cool. So now he's able to get even more out, you know, thinned out of his particular app, so he can get closer to that magic 10 megabytes limit that the app clip size has. He ran into a particular issue where he's like, all right, cool. It's under the 10 megabyte limit. I've finally done everything I need to do, right? And App Store Connect said, no, the thinned app clip size is too large. It's like, what? And it turns out, I'm quoting here, when talking about the 10 megabyte limit, they're not referring to the size of the compressed IPA file, but the size of the actual .app package inside of it. So in order to do that and check it out, he had to verify locally by unzipping the IPA file. And he discovered, oh no, this thing I thought was under 10 megs is actually 13.3 megs. So he ended up rethinking how he was splitting up his app's architecture. And he had already had bits and pieces of his app carved out into frameworks. Right? That's something that I think is maybe not unusual, but not common either. And somewhere in the middle is where the truth lies, where, you know, you probably don't have necessarily everything for your app all in one bundle. You've got it, you know, split out into, all right, this is the networking piece and this is the UI piece at a minimum. And he's got his breakdown here of, you know, what he had for his app target versus extensions and sort of, you know, core layers of his particular app. And he was able to come up with a further breakout that got him like, what do I truly need for this app clip that, you know, doesn't have the full power of like the real app, but has, you know, enough to get you excited and go check things out and ultimately install the app, which is, you know, one of the driving factors that he's looking for, right? You know, you're not looking to install my entire app, but you might try it out as an app clip to sort of get a taste and get excited and go for the full install. That was the final step that got him under the 10 megabyte limit. So I wanted to bring this one up because there was, you know, I think some good nuggets here for folks to use in their apps, and also give you sort of a, if you're not starting from square one, and you're trying to port an existing app of yours to App Clips, you know, what might that mean? It won't necessarily mean the same for you if you're out there listening, because maybe you don't have an app that is very asset heavy, as Chibi Studio apparently was. But if you do have one, now you've got some stuff that you might want to try.
So I'm doing some real-time follow-up on our Friends of the Show Slack channel, which can really excite them all. So while you were talking, I went and downloaded the app clip onto my phone that's got iOS 14 running on it. I made a dev with the hair. What do you call these things? Clippy?
I don't know if they have a name for the avatars, but the name of the app is Chibi Studio.
Yeah, it doesn't really look like you do.
It's dev with the hair.
Oh, it's dev. Doesn't really look like him either.
Well, they don't have a mustache.
I was confused by the beard.
Yeah, they don't have a, like a, he's got sort of a mustache, but it's the only app I've ever seen that has the sort of blue steel look, right? Mm. And that's the closest I could get to his hair on short notice, right? Mm.
This multimedia experience where you get even more when you're in the hashtag friends of the show channel on Slack. So join the Slack group. We've got that.
They'll be looking at this going, what the heck is it? Oh, people are liking it already. Oh, you just, what is this? Mark and Jaime.
What is this merge of Tim and Jaime in a cartoon character?
I look at it as one of those things where, like, you know, a big thing that multi-billion dollar media companies do. Like, hey, you know, there's fans of this, like, Star Trek thing or the Star Wars thing. Do you think we could get some buzz and excitement by just tweeting out random photos from the set? And boy almighty, I was one of those people doing the criminology of, like, oh, what's going on? Is this a character in season 3 of Discovery? Is this a new character in the new Star Wars movie sort of thing? So hopefully the folks in the Friend of the Show channel will say, oh, this must be a spoiler of some sort or a teaser for what's coming up in the show.
Yeah, so you can basically, it's cool because I don't actually go into Test Light and you can download the clip, right? Because you can download the app as well. But just doing the clip, all you do is get the little sort of design studio where you can go in and create a character. You can choose a head style, a body style, and then you go through and you pick the different, you know, hand gestures and stuff like that. And but once you close it, it's gone. It's like, you know, you save the document, but the actual working file isn't there. So it's a good way to sort of introduce the app or the functionality of the app without actually having to buy it or download it or whatever, right? So I don't know if there's a way. Is it like, once I've got it in here, how does it know to go to the app store and buy it? That's the part I'm not sure about. Like, wouldn't you think if you fell in love with it, you'd want to have a link back to the store?
I know we talked about the little store sheet that you can show that looks like a like a little nice pop-up of some sort. Does it not give you that? Is there no, the full thing?
Oh, there's a snapshot. I can take a picture or I can add a picture from the library. I can trash it. I can undo. There's a magic button which just magically makes one for you.
And there's no driver, no call to action that says, oh, want even more options? Download the entire app to continue editing.
Yeah, you would think, eh? Hmm, you can choose colors. I could have chosen to change the color of your hair and stuff like that. But yeah, you would think that one of the buttons there would be. I can't remember. I can't figure out how to get back to where this is. I've got some curly hair on. It definitely looks like Jaime now. But yeah, it's hard to say. Like, I mean, there isn't any sort of way. But I would assume that maybe because this is a Test Light, it doesn't really have a link back to an actual app. Maybe on the store. I don't know.
Oh, that might be a possibility. I don't know how you end up sort of beta testing the store kit related stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you like, it says here at the bottom of the article, if you'd like to try out the app clip I made for Chiba Studio, you can test it on Test Light. Is what I did. So that's cool. All right, I guess we're at the picks portion of our show, so I guess I'll go first. So I saw this one on Twitter. This is an interesting one. We were talking about app schemes a couple of days ago, or Xcode schemes, you know, the last couple of episodes, right? And this is a cool one, and maybe you hadn't thought of this, but when you have an app that has I don't know how many schemes you guys have in your apps. I don't have that many, but you know how when you're in the jump bar and you can start typing in, like if you're looking for, you go into a class or something and it's got like a, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 methods and it's maybe, you know, many, many lines of code deep. You can start typing in the jump bar and it'll short list the stuff based on what you're typing in there. Like if you're looking for view did load, you can start typing view did load and it'll short list just to that one. So you just jump down to that particular thing. Or if you have like a pragma mark, you can jump down to the pragma mark. Well, this is something in schemes. If you click on the scheme, you can actually start typing over top of the scheme name and you can short list down to your scheme. So there's a video here in the link that I've got here showing how you can, you know, just type in some characters and shortlist to whatever scheme you're looking for. That's kind of a handy tip, don't you think?
Yeah, I have certainly carved some of those things down, like let's say like the simulator size, and you can go in manage your devices.
Yeah, simulator is another one too, yeah.
But I never realized that you could just start typing and have it filter there.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. That would have saved a whole bunch of heartache of accidentally clicking another one. Thing. Oh no, I'm starting to build and run the wrong one. Now I have to stop it and go build and run the other one.
Wait another 20 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, for instance, I always use, when I'm working on apps or whatever, I always choose whatever the phone is of the time, right? So, like now I'd be testing on an iPhone 11 or an iPhone 11 Pro
Pro, right? In terms of size, that's what I sort of default to when I'm testing. So I suppose you could just start typing 11 and then get rid of all the other iPads and watches and TVs and stuff like that. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, so this works on the schemes and it works on the test device or the simulator device. I guess it would work on phones too if you had multiple phones. Oh, that's my pick. My second pick is something that, it's a Kickstarter. I got to find a link to the Kickstarter, but then I've linked to the guy's website. So yeah, maybe this does talk about it. So this is, I bought this on Kickstarter sometime last year. Like, it's taken a long time to get here. It just arrived this week. It's from a company called DG Rule or DG Rule Tech. And what it is a USB hub that hugs the bottom of your MacBook Pro. So I knew I was going to get a 13. There was a choice to do, I think it was a 13 or an Air. And what it does is it uses the two USBs on the left-hand side, and the right-hand side plugs into the headphone jack just for stability. And it takes seconds to put it on and take it off and whatever. But on the back, I've got a display port. I've got an HDMI port. And it's not Thunderbolt. It's actually display port. I've got a bunch of USBs. I've got a power in USB-C port. And I've got a regular USB-C port for data as well. So it's kind of handy. It just, and of course, also SD cards. So you can read SD cards and those are kind of memory cards, the mini ones and the full-size ones. But yeah, I think it was like $100 was the Kickstarter. I think you can still get it on Kickstarter. But yeah, it's pretty cool. It's just so far so good. It has a few interesting, like the sound module. One of them is a Realtek USB 2 audio device. So that's what it's using for the audio. And then if you look at the other things if you go to your about this Mac, if you go to the system information thing, you can see some of the drivers that they have for other things in there. But yeah, it's pretty simple. Clips onto the bottom of your MacBook Pro. That's my pick for this week. I've got a couple more devices to test as well, but I'll talk about this in future shows. But that's what I got. And I got a silver one because I wasn't sure if I was going to get space gray or whatever. But I bought it well before I decided to buy the Mac. But there you go.
So it's like a little riser, if I understand, or it sort of tilts it up at a slight angle to fit.
Yeah, it sits up a bit. It tilts it up a slight angle. Yeah, and it sits on. You can see in the video or the picture of the video there. It just adds port to the back of your Mac. It looks very much like the old school my titanium laptop had the, and I think the G3 bit laptops had the ports on the back. Yeah, so it gives you a bit more angle on your typing too. And you can just carry it around, tote it around with you, right? So, and it says here for the it's $129 on the website. It supports 2017 to 2020 devices, right? But and I think it might still be on Kickstarter. I don't know, I'll have to look at it. It was $99 on the Kickstarter. I just thought, what the heck, I'd give it a shot, and so far it's so good. I'm sure we will. I'm using it actually right now as we record the show.
There's almost kind of a shadow pick here on their product page. They have a magnetic charging data cable that is essentially a USB-C output, but with MagSafe type capabilities, as I understand it.
Yeah,
which,
yeah.
I kind of wonder why Apple didn't, continue to use MagSafe even when they switched to USB-C. The idea is still good. It's still solid. I mean, I don't want to drop my device to the floor just because I was dumb enough to trip over my own cable. I kind of want the extra security of, oh, this thing will just pop out. I just plug it back in.
Yeah. By the way, just to cover the ports, be on the page here, it says HDMI mini display port has three USB 3.1s, one USB-C, SD, a micro SD, a Thunderbolt 3, and an audio jack for your headphones.
But what am I going to do with my zip drive?
Well, that you have to get a SCSI interface for.
That's true. Right? Yeah. I think it was SCSI.
So you need a USB to SCSI interface. I don't have to make that. I mean, the only thing is, I guess, the only knock against it does take off two of the ports on the left-hand side, but, you can always plug it in the back. And it doesn't add any volume, really, to the Mac. You can throw it in your laptop bag and away you go. And it's compared to other hubs, which are, they have, like, the square bricks, and they've got, like, a USB cable coming out of them. So there's a picture here on their site. I've got the ones that plug into the ports on the side. Those are the ones I tend to prefer, but this one so far has been pretty good. I've tried a couple of other USBs, and this is the one I'm going.
So it looks like it has a power cable on its own, right? That's that white cable. Can you connect it to a monitor, a USB-C monitor, and have it charge through the monitor?
Yeah. So the one on the left, as I'm looking at it, so looking from the back, the one that would be on the left is the USB-C power cable, and it's actually got a light too. Okay. So it's got a blue light, and when you plug it in, it turns green to show you that it's charging, which is another thing that we don't get on the current MacBooks. We can't really tell other than looking at the menu bar if the thing is charging or not, right?
So that USB-C power, is it also USB data? So in other words,
apparently,
could I connect it to
I haven't really gone through the spec on it yet, but actually you've got the manual here somewhere.
My one question is can you connect it to a monitor and get it charged through a monitor?
Yeah, so like I said, you mean at the same time.
At the same time.
I do have a USB monitor that provides charge. I wonder what would happen if I plugged it in there. But
you should try and report back next week.
Well, it says here that a USB-C multifunction 400 BPS 100 watt.
Okay, that sounds like it does.
Well, that's the one that's by itself, and the other one shows a plug, and it's got SS and like a USB, like as an icon that says SS with a USB thing sticking out of it. So it says on the back USB-C multifunction port of 5K or 2.2 times 4K, 600 hertz video up to 40 gigabytes high speed. USB-C 100 watt power delivery. So I think that means putting power out, though, right? Like if you're powering a device, like a hard drive or something.
Maybe.
The other one is. Yeah, 5 gigabits per second data input, 100 watt power delivery. I don't know. I don't want to plug it in right now while I'm recording because of my problems I mentioned before. Mind you, I'm at 35% battery, so we may get there. Who knows? Anyway, yeah, cool. That's my second pick. Off to you, Jaime.
My first pick is the remote edition of NS Spain. NS Spain last year was, as you might have guessed it, in Spain. This year, due to the pandemic, they decided to go with a virtual conference, and it's kind of unusual and that they're going for an insane continuous 36-hour conference. So presumably, if you have a lot of Red Bull or
no sleep,
more realistically, you're in any part of the world, you'll be able to participate. There will be something that is in your time zone for sure. So this is the first one I think I've seen that was 36 hours straight. I've seen some 24-hour ones, not necessarily iOS ones, but other developer communities. Mm-hmm. But thought 36 hours. That's kind of interesting. Let's see. What are the tickets? Early bird tickets are €199 until September 30th, and standard until they last are €249.
Now, how do you decide what the last means? Like, if you don't have a venue, it doesn't matter how many people connect, does it? Just keep selling those tickets.
I don't know what sort of platform limitations they might have, but yeah, I mean, why would you stop saying no if your platform could support all seven some billion people in the United States? In the world. And €199 looks like $235 United States dollar. And because we have a Canadian audience that's sizable, that is $309 Canadian dollars. So your kilometerage may vary for this.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, after seeing 360 iDev and, of course, WWDC, I think the majority of talks at 360 iDev were recorded ahead of time. As we mentioned before, the speaker was there to participate in the Slack channel during the talk, right? And do a Q&A afterwards. But that was a pretty successful way of doing a conference, right? And you've been to one virtual one since too, haven't you, honey? Since this whole thing started? You went to a meetup, right?
It did the meetup. Actually, today and tomorrow is the API specifications conference, which I've been attending virtually. It's the one I posted on Twitter is like rocking my ASC 2020 shirt.
Right. Gotcha.
But yeah, it's a lot easier to connect into these conferences, if and when I'm available versus, before pre-pandemic world, you would have sort of had to make plans sort of upfront. Like, I think this particular conference, the API specification conference, I think that was in Vancouver, British Columbia last year. So not unreasonable that maybe, week of I might decide, all right, I'm going to take some time off and go drive up, Seattle to Vancouver is not that far. But for people who aren't conveniently in the neighborhood, you probably would have had to think of some air travel, but that's not the case in a virtual world. You can just decide, day of, hey, I think I've got a light schedule. I think I can go ahead and do this and sign up and be ready. No harm, no foul, no fuss, no muss.
We're also doing workshops too. Did they mention what the workshops are? Right here, there's a link.
Yeah, I've never attended an NS Spain. I've heard good things about their conference though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Marin went to one once. Sounds familiar. Probably very cool. What else you got for us?
The other pick, given that we talked about AR Quick Look related to the Apple event logo, is this augmented reality page that they've got specifically around AR Quick Look. So developer at apple.com has a whole bunch of different 3D models you can try out on your iOS device. And they show examples of showing that with custom actions, custom banners, Apple Pay, and then some out there in the real world examples that people have of real products like the, I don't know if this is Hurricane or Huracan Evo RWD spider sports car that's out there, the Sophie bag, which looks like a real thing I think I've seen, and the thing I definitely recognize, the Bethesda gear, which this looks like a Fallout helmet from the Fallout series of video games that they make.
Right. Does this mean like it's a full-size car?
You know, that was actually the one I'm not really a car person, truth be told, so that was actually one of the ones I didn't try. So I didn't see what size it came out to be. I tried out like the little Tinker Toys. I think I tried out the like gramophone. You know, I should have tried the wheelbarrow. That would have been a nice, interesting size. And then I tried out the Bethesda helmet. See what that would look like.
Right now, live on the show. Forward to the your link here. Click on the link with my phone. It's annoying that Google's changed the way that these things work. So just click on one of these. Oh, click on this plane. Clicking on the plane. Come on, plane. Oh, here we go. Oh, look, there's a plane in my.
The plane looked like a toy plane, biplane.
Yeah.
But that spider sports car is one I was kind of interested to see would be. That's more realistic size.
It's on the floor. That's
cool. It's not full size. I'm doing it now.
Okay, so it's not like the kind that you could pretend to sort of walk up to.
Well,
and
still having me move my phone around. We'll find out soon enough. Yeah. I don't know yet.
But I remember when Google was doing those, oh, here are these animals sort of thing. And I was like, oh my gosh, wolves are enormous. Like I knew rationally
they
were big.
I take it back. It is full size. How about that?
Oh, there you go. Car? So there's
I have to back up here.
As the sports car fills up your room, your condo.
And it's very strange because I can't. I have my phone. Okay, I'm going to have to unplug my phone because I can't move it around enough.
Yeah, it's iOS 14 that does the occlusion, right?
No, I think they started adding occlusion in 13, and it was even better when you have the iPad Pro. I think with the hardware that has the 3D sensor in the back.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to figure out my floor, but not my. If you can't figure out that I've got a couch in the room. Mark driving his car.
Yeah.
What's the difference between AR and object in this choice?
Honey? If you click on object, it turns off the camera, so you just see the object. You can move it around.
Oh, yeah, you're just seeing the 3D object in that case and not seeing it augmenting
so
reality.
You're saying the car. Mm-hmm. I'm going to click on the car. But you said it's a full-size car, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of furniture in my phone. Can you move in your phone? Oh,
the Bethesda gear kind of looks like a Cylon a little bit. Old school Cylon.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of inspiration there, that style. Got a little bit
Mark, did you try moving the car?
No, it's too big.
No, I mean, you just grab it with your finger. Oh, where'd it go? I was actually moving. Oh, see, I've got it behind me now. But I was moving it so that... Oh, I got a wheel on my head, but I was moving it so that I was sitting in the driver's seat on my ceiling.
Closed it already. Oh, well.
Great, Jaime. Now I've got a car on my ceiling. Here we go. Okay. If you pinch, you can zoom, but you can also rotate it. I just killed my phone. I think I'm stuck in a wheel well. Yeah, I'm stuck in a wheel well. Oh, well. That's a big model. Interesting. All right, well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you, where would they find you?
I'm on Twitter as @devwithahair.
All right, Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
MarkR@smapsoft.com.
All right, my name is Timitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. So until next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. This is Mike Van Ogmans, MTJC's favorite voiceover artist for some reason. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. Please leave a comment on the website, and if you can, please write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Get a lot of spam if that snaps off email. I might have to stop using it.
Yeah, it's the MTJC bump.
Yeah.
We don't publish it anywhere.
They would have to listen to the show, and it's probably cost prohibitive to just, you know, to get yet another email address to spam. I'm going to have my technology crawl the web, do transcriptions, look for things that sound like they could be email addresses, and then add them to the list. Like, not saying it isn't feasible. I just didn't realize that it would be, you know, cheap enough to do, given the return on investment.
Somebody did, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, yeah, it's totally possible that, you know, since our feed is out there, that people could be using some sort of technology like YouTube or whatever to, like, the auto-translate that they have, right? But, I mean, how would it pick up Smapsoft from you don't spell it like I spell my name, right? I don't get strange people following me on Twitter. Well, I mean, I do, but, and thanks for following me, by the way, strange people, but I don't get, well, like, a lot of them, you know?
I guess you could do variations. If the thing figured out this is something I believe to be an email address, now try doing those one or two character sort of differences to see if I hit something.
Yeah, but I think it's probably much more easier to send him spam the conventional way, right?
It does seem like, you know, rather than merely, you know, going to the ocean and getting a net and getting some fish, like, mm-hmm. setting up a whole sniper mechanism waiting for one fish to cross in front of the barrel and then shoot it. It does seem like a lot.
Maybe buy what you want.
Yeah, a little effort.
Oh, I got the masks finally. They finally
did. Oh, yeah. Good.
Hey, yeah, all awesome. Right.
Yeah, very nice.
Just now all you have to do is go outside.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, you know, they don't help against the smoke.
No.
They do have a pocket for filters, so if you had to go out, it would be better than probably a lot of other masks.
Yeah, I don't bother putting a filter in mine. Carol's working on some other designs too as well. But yeah, those are the ones hand printed by me and Carol.
It's unfortunate how tracking just does not work cross borders, and it just sort of mysteriously disappears for a while. Like, you'll see updates. Mm-hmm. All right, Canada Post. All right, it went from, you know, whatever it is in Toronto to, like, a slightly different place in Toronto. Cool. Nothing.
Did you have a tracking?
It eventually crossed the United States.
Yeah. But did you have a tracking number you could follow?
Not for this one, but you've sent stuff before that showed up as trackable stuff.
Okay, right. Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, Carol always uses the cheapest shipping she can, right? So that's why it probably took a while, Mark.
it's taken a while with, like,
the Bay Area is just awful right now for mail. Just awful.
Yeah, you were saying. Yeah. Crazy.
Thought I'd heard people talking about, like, a 70-some degree swing in some parts of the U.S. in temperature. And it went from, like, close to the hundreds to down in the 30s, which I don't know if that's the Colorado area, but I had some coworkers in Colorado.
Oh, yeah, the Colorado folks were talking about that on Zoom today. Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, that it was a swing that big. It was like, in the hundreds, and now it's about to snow. Crazy.
No.
Yeah, yeah, it's like really? In the 30s.
In Colorado. Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Why is that, I wonder?
Some weird cold front.
Weather swing, yeah. Well, mind you, don't they have the crazy weather like Calgary, Alberta? It can snow any month of the year, and does, right? So you can get snow in August, snow in July.
But don't they usually, you know, hover, not necessarily like a degree or two, but, you know, within 10, 20, 30 degrees. This is in LA's worth of temperature that they lost, which is mind-blowing. Mm. 70 degrees.
Yeah, we went down quite a bit here, but not like it's cold. Like, I'm actually wearing long jeans and socks and a sweatshirt today, right? And yesterday as well, because it just all of a sudden got cold. It's definitely fall.
Yeah, your weather there in Toronto seems, from an outsider who, you know, doesn't follow your weather, but just, you know, once a week we talk about it in this, you know, this Zoom call. I swear, from my perspective, it seems like one week you're like, sorry, the furnace is running, it's super cold, we've got it cranked up. And then the very next week, again, it feels like I'm sweating bullets, you know, I don't have the fan on, sort of thing. It's like, wait, what? How is it possible?
Yeah. Well, not quite that, but yeah, I think over a two months period, we can have quite a swing in temperature. But, like, you know, yeah, we go from plus 40 to minus 40, like, in a year easily.
Wait, really? Plus 40? So you're getting like 100 degrees?
Yeah, we can.
Fahrenheit?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't think we went that high this year. I think we probably went like 35 maybe this year, this summer. Well, no, we peaked, but yeah, we can get quite cold too in the winter, obviously, not in August. Yeah, it does swing. It gets so cold here, it won't snow. No, that's pretty bad. Yep. Anyway. Yeah. By the way, I just want to make a note here that I don't know if you guys have noticed or not, but, like, for Greg noticed on I think June 27th was around that time when he noticed that there's some sort of mechanical staticky noise happening just on my track, right? And I've been scratching my head trying to figure out what the heck is going on. I mean, I know I use an analog mic and I assume it's grounded. You know, I've gone back to the cable I was using, my XLR cable that I was using, you know, for the last couple of years, which didn't seem to have a problem. But I think the problem is
was the grounding on my Mac. And I've been doing some searching around on the interwebs, and apparently there's an issue with the two-prong power adapter that we use, because it doesn't have a third prong. It's not properly grounded. And so it's whether or not I'm touching the computer or not touching the computer as to whether or not the static shows up. So today, as an experiment, just to see how it goes, I'm only using my DisplayPort adapter. I'll talk about that in my pick, and a USB-C to plug my my microphone and my preamp into, right? So we'll see if hopefully, knock on wood, I don't get any. I have someone here right here. Hopefully, I don't get any static in my track today. So I'm pulling my hair out trying to figure out where it's coming from, and it's a real pain, because the only way to get rid of it is to actually put a lot of denoise filters on, and I sound like I'm underwater a lot of times, right? Anyway, technical issues, challenges. So apologies to those of you who noticed it on the shows previously. Hopefully, I'm working on it, trying to figure out what the heck it is. And you know what's interesting, Jaime, is it didn't really show up as much on Spotcast as it did on. More Than Just Code was horrible last week. The track out. Even if I used the Zoom thing, the Zoom panel, it still had a bit of, you could hear it a bit in there too. Even though Zoom kind of smooths a lot of that gunk out, right?
Yeah, I don't hear it at all.
Hear it now, and I obviously don't hear it now either. But it's like what I'm doing is I'm recording with QuickTime directly onto my Mac, and of course there's no interfaces, no VU meters, there's no sort of, I can't see any sort of odd thing happening. All I get is like a meter that shows the volume at which I'm speaking, right? But yeah, it's really, really annoying. Anywho.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.